From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, the story of Sculpture Milwaukee, which adorns Wisconsin Avenue from 6th Street to the lakefront.
What I wanted was something that represented a kind of range of what is possible in sculpture.
And how one sculpture took its place in the exhibition.
The work to be successful in the public venue needs to have tooth, which is to say that it's having a dialogue, and it is a dialogue that you can perceive and that people understand.
Then Danielle Trissoni's memoir tells the story of what she thought would be a fairy tale marriage until it wasn't.
I think the lesson to take away from this, at least for me, is that, you know, life is imperfect. We're imperfect. Relationships are imperfect. And be forgiving, you know, it's okay if something doesn't work out perfectly.
Lake Effect is next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. On May 31st, a project years in the making officially opened to the public. Sculptures of various shapes, sizes, and materials appeared along a stretch of Wisconsin Avenue in downtown Milwaukee, from 6th Street all the way to the lakefront, where they'll remain until the fall. The project is called Sculpture Milwaukee, and it's the brainchild of Milwaukee business leader and philanthropist Steve Marcus.
The official kickoff took place 7 floors below the Lake Effect studio at street level in the Chase Tower. That is where a sculpture designed by Santiago Calatrava has found a home in the flower bed on the east side of the plaza along Water Street.
Sculpture Milwaukee was curated by Russell Bowman, who led the Milwaukee Art Museum from 1985 to 2002. In an interview that first aired at the end of May, we caught up with him just as the Calatrava sculpture was going in, and we invited him upstairs to talk about the project. Russell Bowman, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Well, you're here as the curator of this entire Milwaukee sculpture project, all gazillion pieces that are on the street.
Yes, or, I guess all praise or all blame comes to me.
Comes to you. And I know you have a history with Milwaukee. You're the one who basically made sure we got the thing that represents Milwaukee now, the wonderful Calatrava wing of the Milwaukee Art Museum.
Well, I was at the Milwaukee Art Museum for many years, from 1985 to 2002 as director. So through the Calatrava project. That was a thrilling project to be part of. He was wonderful to work with. It was a very ambitious project. The city was ambitious to do it. When we were building it, we wanted the museum just to be more noticed than it was, because the 1975 David Kaler building was a wonderful building for the collection, but it didn't announce itself from outside. We wanted something that sort of announced itself, and we got it. And we didn't quite imagine that it would become the sort of symbol of the city that it's become. But that's a wonderful thing to have happened. And so it was nice to be a part of that project and to be able to come back and visit it.
Take me back to the beginning of this project, of this temporary installation, although it feels very permanent because there's some big pieces
there
going
are.
In. But it is temporary. How did this all come about and how did you get invited?
This really is the vision of Steve Marcus, who came up with this idea 3 or 4 years ago for a temporary sculpture exhibition along Wisconsin Avenue that he hoped would bring people back to Wisconsin Avenue and to downtown. Then he tried to work with various institutions, I think, to try to lay the groundwork for doing this, and was somewhat frustrated in the attempt. I had an art advisory service in Chicago and worked with Steve Marcus, among others, so some people in Milwaukee. But I also had a gallery operating under the same name. And I closed the gallery a year or two ago because I was anxious to have more kind of time to myself and more time to travel. And my wife had retired and so forth and so on. So when I did that, Steve suddenly said, "Oh, you've closed the gallery. Now you can do my project in Milwaukee." And I wasn't sure I wanted to do his project in Milwaukee because it was a very ambitious one. And I didn't really know if it was possible. He wanted the work to be offered for sale so that a percentage of those sales, however many there will be, and there won't be all 22 of them, could come back to fund future years of the project, because he wanted to do it annually. So that was his idea. I didn't know if galleries and artists and so forth would be anxious to lend or consign works for the entire summer in Milwaukee, outdoors, in an urban environment. And I was really kind of astonished by what happened because I convinced Steve, or I think he wanted to do it from the beginning, I said, if we're going to do it, we sort of have to do it like the Art Museum Project. We have to do something that we think can be world class. I mean, we want to represent Milwaukee with something important that other people regard as important. And that's where we should start. So, and he agreed with that. So I began by, you know, calling some of the major artists and major galleries in the country to see if they would consider consigning or lending work. And I sort of expected to get, oh, no, you know, why would we do that in Milwaukee? It's not a big enough market for us and so forth and so on. And that's absolutely not what I got. I got from the beginning, oh, we know about the museum, we know about the museum building, we know about Milwaukee. It seems like a very sort of progressive American city. They were ready to go from the beginning.
Were you surprised by that?
And I was surprised by that. And then I was kind of stuck.
Now you have
to
do it.
I mean, I was
it.
Thinking, you know, well, maybe I'll do, you know, 3 months of work and I'll say, Steve, I'm sorry, it's not possible, and that'll be that. Well, it didn't work out that way, happily. So it's been quite remarkable from the beginning how many artists and galleries and so forth were anxious to work with us, and I hope that can continue into the future.
One of the things that's so fascinating right now, because as we are speaking, the installation is happening. When this airs, it will be the day before it officially opens to the public. But I walked up and down Wisconsin Avenue yesterday just to watch people working on the installations of the various pieces along the avenue. And you know, I can see people walking by on their business and kind of looking and thinking, what is going on?
Right.
And all these different workmen, you know, putting different pieces, and the pieces are so different. I want to ask you about the choice. How did you come to choose the 22 pieces that ultimately are going to line Wisconsin Avenue?
Well, what I wanted was something that represented a kind of range of what is possible in sculpture. So I wanted a range of generations. I mean, we have artists who made their reputations in the 60s, and we have artists who made their reputation after 2010. So there are multiple generations, and there are multiple approaches to sculpture. I mean, some is figurative, some is abstract, some is sort of narrative, it tells a story. Some is really conceptual. Some pieces are actually built on site. We have three pieces that are actually constructed on site rather than being a discrete object that you move around. So we wanted to sort of show all those possibilities. And frankly, we wanted things of quality that were serious, but also sometimes playful, funny. I mean, if you look at Tony Tassett's mood sculpture, with the emojis that go from sort of sad to glad, it's funny. So we were looking for things that were approachable as well.
I happen to really love the deconstructed tire it's up a little east of us.
The Chikaya Booker.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is quite wonderful.
Well, you know, she's African-American artist who works with this material because she saw tires, you know, being abandoned and filling, you know, vacant lots and so forth. And she sort of repurposed them. And there's a whole tradition of that, you know, in African-American culture of repurposing things or even using tires to make lawn decorations or whatever. Well, she takes it way beyond that and uses these tires to sort of suggest figures, animals, these things that maybe suggest an African heritage sometimes, but you're not quite sure. And they're really intriguing, and you keep trying to figure out what she's suggesting.
As I was going by it yesterday, I thought to myself, oh, that's like Chalulie in rubber.
Right.
Yeah, because it's got that kind of wonderful exuberance.
Yes, sometimes they're very spiky.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yep.
You know, again, she's very different than, say, the Tony Craig down the street, which is purely abstract, but also in a curious way, vaguely figurative. The Tony Craig, which has sort of become the symbol of the show in certain ways, is like a sort of tornado of energy. But it also, if you look at it carefully, if you move around it, human profiles sort of appear out of those swirling clouds. And it's just an extraordinary thing that he can make that in, you know, 18 feet of bronze.
And I think that's the thing, as I was walking up and down the street and looking at all of the different materials that were being used, the different moods that were evoked, it just makes it fun to go up and down the street. It's like, what am I going to come up to next?
That's what we hope, you know, people will find. It's really interesting to see the sculpture, too, in an urban environment. One of the surprises to me, because we have a lot of sculpture that's fairly big. I mean, you know, 18 feet, 26 feet, 40 feet. The 40-foot one, the St. Clair Semin, we looked at it and we said, gee, it's not as big as we thought. And it's because in the urban environment, you know, you have all these buildings that are much, much taller. But it's interesting to see whether the shapes are organic or whether they are geometric. The Joel Shapiro that's just on the other side of this building is very geometric, although it also evokes a figure. But it plays off of the architecture in really interesting ways.
When you were deciding where the different pieces were going, did the urban environment dictate to you in some way? Like, oh, this is going to look great against this building, or no, I don't want it against that
building.
Sure
it did. Yeah. And then after that, there was the whole process, which I didn't quite anticipate, of structural drawings. Every piece had to be engineered and the structural drawing drawn for how it's installed. Everything had to be permitted by the city. The city felt that every permit had to have the approval of the private owners of the buildings nearby. So that was quite a process. And Milwaukee Downtown, which has administered this project, did much of that work. But it was quite a project. And sometimes we couldn't put things where we wanted to, either because structurally the street or the plaza couldn't support them or whatever. But I think we've worked it out pretty well.
Is there one that you wish you could have put somewhere that you couldn't?
There is. But, you know, I'm happy with the way it's worked out. And I think everything is very well sited. So I'm pleased.
Now, I got you away from an installation that's happening right now to come up here and talk with us. And that is, coming back to Calatrava, it is a Calatrava.
It's a Calatrava sculpture. He's always made sculpture, but in recent years only made large-scale outdoor sculpture. This is a sculpture that's been displayed once before. He did a project on Park Avenue in New York. And yes, we're installing it just below here. The person who fabricated it with Calatrava is here putting it together because in a typical Calatrava fashion, it's a kind of engineered piece. It's in multiple parts that have to be strung together and held in place by sort of tensile strength. It's a complicated piece, but it looks so simple and so sort of ethereal in a certain way. I'm really excited to see it here in place.
And it's on the Chase, we should say it's on the Chase Plaza, because we're in the Chase Building downtown, and it's near the riverside of the plaza.
No, it's actually on the east side. It's on the Water Street side.
Oh, okay.
Joel Shapiro is on the riverside. And they are, again, two very different sculptures, although they work with abstract elements. Calatrava's is purely abstract. And almost a mathematical kind of solution. Shapiro vaguely suggests a figure, but it's a figure that plays off the architecture around it very well. It's interesting. We had a photograph of the Shapiro, which was also shown in New York in front of the Seagram building. On the plaza here, it looks almost as good against the bank building.
Now, I realize I'm looking ahead here. This is going to be up until October, right?
Correct.
Are you going to be part of the disinstallation?
Yes.
Okay. So that's the whole other piece of this I think a lot of people don't think about. All of this has to be taken down and shipped to its home or its next place.
Well, you know, getting it here, I mean, it came from New York. It came from California. It came from Canada. I mean, there were various pieces in various places. And it's an incredibly complex thing to just arrange the shipping to get it here on time.
And safely.
But a lot of it was staged so that the larger pieces could come on a certain day and be installed that day. And it will be equally complicated taking them down. So it's really a pretty massive project to do this. And Steve Marcus is the one who made that possible, not only with the idea, but with the support and helping to raise support from others in the community. I mean, there are other people who are making gifts to support this project, you know, to make it possible sort of as a gift to Milwaukee. I mean, he sees it as free to the public. I mean, it's a gift to people that they can just walk downtown and enjoy.
Do you think that there will be any idea that some of these pieces will end up staying, or is that just not part of this particular project?
We hope so. I mean, we hope that one or two or three pieces will be sold. They're more likely to be sold here than somewhere else in the country, although that could happen too. And so we're hoping that a couple will stay here. And there are a couple of pieces like the Saul Witt that's being built in place, which is being built out of concrete block. I mean, there are masons working on it right now.
I was watching it yesterday, yeah.
It will probably stay until next summer. So there are just a couple of pieces that will stay.
But it would just be wonderful if, you know, something became so much a part of the fabric of downtown that people can't imagine it leaving.
What Steve would like would be the temporary project to happen every year and almost be like Summerfest. So, and it would be another thing that you come to Milwaukee to see. We'll see. We have our fingers crossed.
How does it feel for you to come back to Milwaukee to do such a big art project after leaving the museum?
I loved Milwaukee all the years that I was here, and I particularly loved working with people in the community. I mean, that sounds like such a Pollyanna thing to say, but it's really true. I really enjoyed working here. I mean, I love Chicago, and I love living there, but I'm glad I'm near Milwaukee. We also have a house in Lake Geneva so that we're nearby, and that was fortunate for this project. That was another thing that allowed me to do it. So I'm really happy to be back in Milwaukee working on this project, and I hope it does have future years, although I hope to share more of the work with a larger team the next time around.
Now you know exactly who you need to help.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And we've had an extraordinary amount of help. I mean, again, through Milwaukee downtown, the BID district, and various both people who've been paid to do parts of the project and volunteers. It's really been incredible.
Russell Bowman is the curator of Sculpture Milwaukee, the 5-month-long installation of sculptures along Wisconsin Avenue in downtown Milwaukee. Bowman headed the Milwaukee Art Museum from 1985 to 2002, and he now runs Chicago-based Bowman Art Advisory.
After we spoke in May, Bowman took me downstairs to meet several people key to the installation of the Calatrava sculpture, which is at the corner of Water Street and Wisconsin Avenue. First, we caught up with Roger Machen, the co-owner of Methods and Materials. Tell me about the job that you do to make this kind of thing happen. Your company does this kind of installation,
right? We work all over the country. We're based in Chicago, which means we're never too far from anywhere. We've been working with Russell for a few years on different projects in Milwaukee. So when this came along, it really was our cup of tea. So the beautiful thing about this show is there's a real variety of skills required for all different types of materials, which has got the heavy rigging, And the lighter touch that we need for sort of the wrapping and the more conservation type needs. So we've got people doing a little bit touch-up painting, other guys grinding and welding. So it's the whole sort of cavalcade of equipment that we drag out here.
How many people do you have along the street working?
6 right now. And 2 more back in Chicago doing some fabrication. And they'll be back tomorrow for the final installation of the Ryman piece over at U.S. Bank.
So we are standing in front of one of the Calatrava.
The Calatrava,
piece.
Yeah.
So what are some of the challenges of this piece in particular?
Actually, I'm only seeing this for the first time. Fortunately, we've got the fabricators, Philip and Seth, from California. So they're really directing our guys of how this whole thing goes together.
And the other piece over there.
Do you want to walk over there to the other one?
Yeah. We were watching that yesterday with the crane, you know, lowering the piece in. And so I'm assuming that's your folks too, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
So for that one, we had a slightly different crane called a double drum, which allows us to rotate it in midair because it gets shipped upside down because that's the easiest way of shipping it. And you might have watched, we turned it over and they were able to set it onto this base, which we fabricated in Chicago.
When you're getting ready to install a piece like this, how long does it take to kind of do all of the work ahead of time to know?
Well, the more time we have, the more efficient it can be, but there's always changes. So I always think we want to be sort of, there's going to be 80% of the work we've got well and organized in advance, and about the other 20% we have to figure out in the field. I mean, it's no fun if it's all plan A. Plan B, plan C is usually more fun.
Roger Machen is the co-owner of the Chicago-based Methods and Materials. His company was responsible for installing all of the Sculpture Milwaukee pieces along Wisconsin Avenue.
As Machen left to oversee another installation farther west, we turned to the fabricator who was working on the Calatrava.
My name is Philip Stewart. I have a studio called Pinwheel that we fabricate the work of several artists commercially for them. And then we also fabricate the work that I design.
Okay. And so you fabricated this piece that's going in right now.
Yes. It's cool that it's 24 separate items that are just floating in space. You know, there's nothing holding anything together but a wire. And that's really, I think, the, you know, so there's a tensional integrity there that's quite interesting, is that it's not a structure until it's complete. The tail of it, the little end, it comes back and it ties into the first piece on a little leash that has a spring-loaded shock absorber inside of it to cancel out the breeze moving the tail, you know, so that it would kind of be standardized, it would just kind of move.
Yeah. And have you worked with Santiago Calatrava before?
Not before these.
No, so this is new for you.
This was sort of new for him, too.
Oh, okay. You know, does like he normally do his own?
His art practice was narrow. You know, like he was an architect and an engineer. As, you know, like he's now represented by the Marlboro Gallery. He's a great artist. And so there's sort of a different approach now. Now there's all of a sudden, you know, sort of a viable approach to making art. So he's, you know, it's a new process for the number of pieces that are being generated, the scale of them. I mean, he has a long history of public works that are singular, right? I've seen a lot of them, and they're great. And I always appreciated his work. And so to be able to have the chance to work with him and do a project like this was, I signed up for immediately, because that's what we do. We like challenges, you know?
Well, and I imagine he has to trust you to do this right. That's a big deal for an artist.
Well, it is.
You're an artist yourself.
Yeah.
So would you trust somebody to do this?
Would I?
Yeah, of your own piece?
Yeah, I would now. I would trust Seth, you know,
because
he's used to it and knows how to do it, right? But it takes a unique person to have the skill set to be able to work in this kind of a field, because it's not art only. Art is one informing practice. Engineering is a significant thing in public art. It's almost all driven by engineering and liability more than anything else. So we spend a lot of energy around those things. And so it takes a multifaceted sort of practice to be able to function. You know, you can't just be an artist. You have to be an engineer and an artist and a coordinator and an acquisitions person and a shipper. And you have to pull your hair out a lot.
So what are some of the unique challenges for this? I mean, we're standing on the Chase Tower Plaza grounds, and you're putting it in a flower bed.
Well, it's meant to be in a flower bed. It started in a flower bed on its last installation. So this is nice in that respect. It was meant to do that. So when you make a big piece that's outside, the environment is the base. You don't need to sort of make it precious by putting it on a base. The environment is the base. It's large enough and demanding enough to hold its own position. And so our job here is to place it in such a way that it has a dialogue with its surroundings. And it's a dialogue. It's not a subservient role to the architecture. It's not a dominating role. It's a conversation that I think one artist in a conversation that I had who was very, very skilled at public art placement, she said a work to be successful in the public venue needs to have what she called tooth, which is to say that it's having a dialogue, and it is a dialogue that you can perceive. And that people understand, you know, and they might not get it immediately, but especially over the time of existing with something, if you're working in that environment every day, it becomes an entity with its own character in that space. So it's all about the dialogue. And so here, when we install it, we're going to actually wait to do the final placement until we get some of it up there so that we can, you know, rotate it a little and look. And, you know, take advantage of looking at where the people are coming from, looking at what these major view corridors are, and then balancing the experience of viewing it with its relationship to public safety. Because, of course, you know, we'd rather just put it out in the middle, right? But that's not going to work, because some people don't understand that you shouldn't climb on it. So we try to do this, where it's still having that dialogue in your presence, but it's maybe just slightly removed.
Philip Stewart is an artist and fabricator working out of his California studio, Pinwheel. He oversaw the installation of the Santiago Calatrava sculpture in the flower bed along the eastern edge of the Marine Plaza, right by the Chase Tower.
We'll take a short break now, and then Wisconsin native Danielle Trussoni talks about her memoir, The Difficult Story of How Her Marriage Ended. That comes your way next on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Wisconsin native Danielle Trussoni wrote a memoir 10 years ago focused on her childhood in La Crosse and how she came to terms with her dad, who had suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder from his service as a so-called tunnel rat during the Vietnam War.
That book helped launch Trussoni's literary career, which then turned to fiction and two novels that straddled the line between thriller and supernatural. They were written at the time Trussoni was married to a Bulgarian man who was at turns brilliant and also enigmatic and disturbing.
A little more than a decade after that first memoir came out, Trussoni's latest memoir, The Fortress, was released last year. It's just out in paperback. It tells the story of that crumbling marriage and a last-ditch effort to shore it up with a move to a medieval manor in France. Danielle Trussoni joins us via Skype from France, although Paris in this case. Thanks for taking a few minutes to talk.
Oh, I'm so happy to be back, Mitch. Thank you.
This is a pretty tough book to read. The further you get through it, the fewer moments of light we see. And so I imagine it could not have been an easy book to write either. So why was it important for you to write it?
Oh, such a good question. It's interesting that you say it's a hard book to read. And I wonder if it's a hard book to read because of the, you know, the subject matter is really about the struggle to keep a marriage together, a long-term marriage. We were married for 10 years. And so I don't know if that's, in, you know, if that's what you mean when you say it's hard to read.
Yeah, I mean, I it's such an intimate book and, you know, it almost in some ways feels like, you know, watching a neighbor's marriage disintegrate or a relative, you know, someone you care about, because we care about you from reading this book and from reading your other books, obviously. And so, you know, it's never enjoyable to see such pain, you know, that real people are dealing with.
Right. Well, that's interesting that you say it's like, you know, it's like watching something that happens to your neighbor, because before the dissolution of my marriage, that's how I always viewed it, as something that, oh, this is never going to happen to me. We all know people who have, you know, been in marriages that didn't work or relationships that didn't work. And I think that it is, you know, it's sort of like watching a tragedy unfold before your very eyes. Now, writing the book, you know, it's a memoir. So everything in the book is something that I experienced in relatively recently. And writing, you know, to go back to your original question of it must have been a hard book to write. You know, you're absolutely right. It was very difficult. And for the first year that I tried to work on this, like right after we split up, I immediately felt the need to process what I was going through by writing it down. I spent about a year just noodling, you know, like just writing stuff down.
And you said, as you said just a moment ago, you know, everybody has seen other people go through something like this. This is actually, you know, you had a marriage before this that came apart, but not in this way.
Yeah, well, the thing is about this is that I was very dedicated to this relationship. I had invested a lot in it emotionally. I saw it as, you know, I saw this relationship as my lifelong relationship. He was going to be my partner for life. That's what I thought when we met, and for a large part of the relationship. So I think, you know, the book is not so much, like a lot of my thoughts in the book are about keeping the relationship together. The book is really about persevering under circumstances that are difficult. And I think, you know, just in my, I think you've read my first book. I'm not sure if you did.
Oh, but
I'm
of course sure I did. Yes.
The first time we spoke was about that book. I grew up in Wisconsin. You know, I was the daughter of people who were divorced. I had a difficult relationship with my father, who was a Vietnam vet. And I promised myself, I think early on, that I wouldn't have a dysfunctional family. I think none of us go into situations, into relationships, thinking that they will. And so with this, you know, I had a previous relationship before this marriage when I was pretty young. But this one was the one that was going to work. And so really a large part of this book is about having dreams, trying to make those dreams work, and going to extremes in many ways to make them work. You know, in my mind, this relationship, my marriage was going to be, it was going to be happy, successful, and all of the sort of stereotypical ways that a marriage is happy and successful. And when that wasn't happening, I just sort of soldiered on and pushed myself to try to make it that way. I had a belief that with a lot of hard work and a lot of imagination, relationships can work. And I think the lesson to take away from this, at least for me, is that, you know, life is imperfect. We're imperfect. Relationships are imperfect. And be forgiving. You know, it's okay if something doesn't work out perfectly.
Well, right. And to that end, you said a few minutes ago that the idea behind moving to this kind of medieval fortress in the south of France was the two of you wanted to put your relationship back together. But in reading your telling of it, it doesn't necessarily seem like Nikolai, who was your, you know, ex-husband, was necessarily ever truly on board with that plan anyhow.
Yeah. I think he wasn't truly on board for a lot of things in our marriage, to be quite honest. But no, I was largely behind our move to France. I had always wanted to learn French. I had I'm a little bit of a Francophile. We have children. I wanted them to learn French. I had just had a big success with a book, and we had some extra money, and I said, let's go to France and let's go to some place that's really far removed from all of the troubles that we've had. We were living in Providence, Rhode Island before that, and it just wasn't working out there. We had a lot of problems, and I said, let's just remove ourselves completely from the situation. Let's start over. And we tried. And no, you're right. I think he did end up enjoying certain parts of being in France, but in the end, he was not on board with that. And it ended up not working at all, which is why this is a memoir. when it doesn't work out, it makes good, you know, it's good for memoir.
Well, and especially now, and I don't think this is a spoiler, you are about to get remarried. My outsider's view is that you seem to be pretty happy at this stage. It would be really easy to relegate that period of your life to a file cabinet in the back of your mind. I mean, you could have written these journals, you could have put them away someplace and just gone on with life.
I could have, but you know, I think that this is what makes me a writer. I can't just do that with my experiences. And so I think that that's what just makes me is that when situations or, you know, experiences happen, in order for me to think about them clearly or to relegate them to the closet, I need to write through them. That's my way of being in the world.
There's a pivotal point, I think, fairly early in your relationship, which I guess didn't really turn into a pivotal point until much later. But you caught Nikolai reading your personal journals, and after you had, you know, sort of expressly told him he shouldn't. And I wonder if you have come to sort of a different terms about what's personal in your life and what's not, because in a way the book kind of feels like a personal journal.
Right. Well, you know, that memoir is, I think as a form, memoir is wonderful and people love memoir because it does bring a reader very close psychologically and emotionally to the writer. That said, I see this book as it's very constructed. Right?
Sure.
It's not just everything thrown out there. There's a lot of thought behind what I reveal and what I don't reveal. It's not something, you know, I'm very careful about that as a writer.
One of the other things that strikes me in reading about this time is that there are places and times in the book and, you know, and in the chronology where you seem to be very much in touch with what attracted you to Nikolai in the first place. Sections of the book in which you're really pretty kind to him and sections of the book where you are not so kind to yourself.
Well, I think that that's realistic. Honestly, if this book were just about me being perfect or correct or the right one, you know, often in divorce stories, this isn't a divorce story, but in with my friends, you know, if you're sitting at a cafe or whatever, having a coffee with a friend, often you'll hear like everything that was wrong with the other person and nothing that's wrong about your friend, right? That's definitely not what I wanted to do here. What I wanted to do is examine myself. And in order to do that, I don't know, realistically and compassionately, I had to look at what was wrong with me. And so you're right. There are a lot of places in the book where I'm hard on myself or realistic about what my problems were, because I had a lot of them. At the same time, I think that I try to be pretty clear about what went wrong in the relationship and why I was attracted to this person. You know, the book is, there are a lot of wonderful things about my ex-husband, and I wouldn't have been attracted to him and I wouldn't have loved him if those things didn't exist. So it would be completely disingenuous of me and unrealistic as a writer to not include those parts in the book too.
And maybe this goes back to the earlier question about the file cabinet in the back of your mind. You write that Nikolai had some things in his metaphorical file cabinet that after more than a decade with him, you really only kind of generally knew they existed and that they were a huge weight on him, but you never knew what they were.
Yeah, there was a real, this I think is part of the reason this relationship didn't work out. He was very closed. Emotionally, he shut down if there was anything that got too close to whatever problems he'd had. He was, he's a very talented person. He was performing as a pianist when he was 9 years old. And I think anyone who has that kind of pressure on that kind of talent, first of all, second of all, that kind of pressure, they have issues in their life that they have to deal with, and he just never did. Part of my, whether it's because of the way I grew up or part of the way I am, is I always wanted to help him figure those out. I was never welcome to do that. He didn't want me there. And, you know, honestly, he never really addressed them. And I don't know why. I think that our relationship, you know, clearly, like, a relationship is about two people communicating. So I think if this part of our relationship had been better, you know, there wouldn't be a memoir right now. There would be a different story being told. But it taught me one thing. And, you know, this is a really important lesson that I learned, is that you can't make people give you what they can't give. And even, you know, despite the fact that I tried for many, many years in this relationship to open up doors that were closed and to make opportunities that, you know, that weren't there, in the end, you can only accept what people will give you. And to be an adult and to be responsible in a relationship and to feel loved and to actually have something that works, it needs to be equal. You need to give as much as you take.
One of the hardest parts of the book to read is experiencing how your kids were caught in the middle of all of this. Do you think, is this memoir going to either today or someday down the road help them process what they went through?
Well, we've talked a lot about it. I am a very open, open kind of mom. And, you know, during the process, you know, during the divorce, we were talking all the time. And after, I think that they are processing and have processed it pretty well. I don't think this book is going to be, you know, a sort of manual for them, but I do think that it will be interesting for them maybe in 10 or 15 or 20 years to go back and look at it.
I wonder, I mean, given the first memoir you wrote, whether, you know, what a memoir by one or both of your kids about this time might look like.
Oh, I would love to read it. I would love it. I would love to read it. Although they were pretty young. But still, that, you know, my daughter was 8 and 9 when this was going on, and my son was 12. So even, you know, just recently I was asking, them, like, what do you remember about Obey? And what do you remember about this experience? Because now we've been back in the States for 4 years. We came back in 2012. And my son is like, oh, I remember playing soccer. And I remember the things that they remember. I remember the ice cream at the boulangerie. The things that they remember are so, you know, clearly, obviously, from their perspective. And their perspective, they were very protected from a lot of the darker things that were going on.
Well, and thankfully, I would imagine.
Thankfully, right. I mean, it was something that I was very careful about and tried very hard to do. Although at the same time, are we ever able to protect our children, really? I mean, I think that we have this idea that, or some of us do, that it's possible to construct, you know, a pillow lined, you know, sort of existence for them where they're not going to get hurt. They're not going to scrape their knee. They're not going to experience bad things. But in reality, we do. Kids do. All of us do. And it's just about learning how to get through it and have resilience and become better people after it's all happened. That for me is the important thing.
You've been out of touch with your ex-husband for some time now. At least if I read that correctly in your book, would you imagine he is going to read this?
I don't know. I wrote to him a couple of months ago and told him I'd written it and told him, you know, I asked permission to use some material that he had written to me in it. And he said, no, you can't use it. You can't use that material. So he knows, you know, he knows that it's coming out. I imagine he won't read it. But that's his prerogative, you know. It's his choice. He's a writer. He's written memoirs. He knows what it's like to write a memoir, and he knows what it's like, I think, for other people to be written about. So I don't know. That's an unknown, an unknown factor in this.
Well, Danielle Trissoni, I hope a lot of other people read it.
Me too. I hope so, and I hope that people. I hope people actually bring away something that reflects. I know that Obey in the south of France is very far away from the Midwest, but I hope that people are able to bring their own experiences to the book or take away something worthy from the book.
Well, thank you so much.
Thanks, Mitch.
Wisconsin native Danielle Trissoni's memoir is called The Fortress, A Love Story. It comes out in paperback today. Trissoni now lives in New York, but we reached her last year via Skype from Paris.
One last break, and then we visit a local park that was reclaimed from both a quarry site and then a city landfill. We head to Hartung Park when Lake Effect continues on WUWN. With more of Lake Effect, I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Back on April 22nd, Earth Day, we visited a local park that was quite literally carved out of garbage.
Hartung Park is 20 acres above the Menominee River. It was named in honor of the family that once quarried the parcel that straddles Wauwatosa and Milwaukee. Post-quarry, the land became a landfill dumping site for the city, but over the last decade or so, neighbors transformed it into a park.
Lake Effect's Susan Benz toured Hartung Park in April with one of the neighbors who shepherded the park's creation, from each piece of playground equipment to every native plant.
I'm Lynn Worley, and I am on the board of the Hartung Park Community Association.
So what came first, the association or the park?
The park as we see it today, it was definitely second. The association was founded in 2005, at the time when Alderman Bowl approached some neighbors about the idea that what was here, which at that time was a landfill, that they were daily dumping soil and road waste into with big dump trucks running through the streets, that was going to come to an end. in a couple years, and he wanted to get some neighbor input on ideas.
How many years did that dumping go on? Do you have any idea?
I believe that the quarry was in the 1950s, before, and then it became a landfill somewhere in the 1950s. So, and it was the, at the time that it closed, it was the last City of Milwaukee landfill within the city boundaries.
There would not have been something toxic dumped here, or is that uncertain?
Well, there's methane.
Okay, well,
there's definitely methane, and a neighbor of mine who lives next to me, who grew up in this neighborhood, said that certainly people dumped things like televisions and refrigerators and things like that.
Which would have dicey stuff in
it. Yeah. So we're in the newest part right now. We just opened this last summer. So you can imagine then, if the group started in 2005, we opened the first section about 2010. So we thought this would be a couple of years project. And quite honestly, when a prairie, we're growing prairies, so a prairie takes about 3 years to really come in. So that's why in this section, you're seeing a lot of mud today, with a little bit of grass and prairie coming up.
Now, part of this is
that... Did you want to go up first so you can look down on the whole thing? Would that be helpful?
Yeah. Okay. That'd be cool. So when you moved in here, did you have kids?
No. I moved in 2004. We saw an announcement for a potluck in 2005, and my husband actually went to that. I didn't go to it, but that's where the neighbors were first meeting. And then in the fall of 2005, there were community information sessions at which they were presenting the design. The design was created by Jason Wilkie, who is a resident of the neighborhood. He's a landscape architect, and he volunteered his time. He's also now an alderman in Wauwatosa. So he had presented this idea of originally the plan was just flat grass. You know, finish the landfill, cap it off, do what most places do and just make a relatively uninteresting place. As you can see looking around you, we are anything but flat grass as we walk up the hill and start to puff a little bit.
So when you moved in, Lynn, then the landscape, the topography looked much as it does now. I mean, just the basic.
No, this hill wasn't here.
Okay.
This hill was a lot of more dumping and use of the bulldozer to get it into shape. Very carefully.
So
put it
moving
into shape.
Around what was already here.
No, they were still dumping. They dumped in here through 2014.
Wow.
Yeah. And then so we had already had the prairie down there, and the trucks were still coming in. They used to come off 99th Street and off of Argonne Drive, and they took turns every other month coming in. When we moved in, if you left our windows open on the back, like this time of the year we would do that, all day for 8 to 10 hours you'd hear beep, 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 because the trucks were always backing up. So it was fence, and then it was soil, and it was scrub brush, and some of the trees around the perimeter, and there's a few trees that were the original ones that were already in here. Most of the trees you see were added. And the prairie grass is doing great. We had a prairie specialist come through here last year, and he was just really, he helps us maintain it, but he said this is such a fabulous prairie. It's really worked out well. It looks short right now. You have to use your imagination. By the middle of summer, all these pads that are up here, not down on the grassy field, but all these pads that are up here, the grass is about as high as I am.
Wow.
So cool. Up to about 5 feet.
And tell me about this bridge.
Oh, so the bridge.
The blue bridge.
Yeah. The bridge, it was an old bridge that was reclaimed from a different part of Milwaukee and reused. The City of Milwaukee, the guys who were putting this together, they did just a fabulous job finding things that existed and just bringing them in. So you can see from here, now we're at about the highest point. And if you look towards the playground, that was the earliest section.
Okay.
So a couple years after we started meeting, we had this plan. The City of Milwaukee came back to us and said, you know what? We love your plan because the hills are high, so now we can fit more in. We thought they were going to close it in a couple of years and start the park process. We negotiated to finish off from this playing field that you're looking up through the playground.
Okay.
So it was about 6 acres of the final 20 acres. So we always think about that as part one. Then where the pond and the labyrinth are, which we're looking down on, that was part two. The pond is actually part of the water management system in the city of Milwaukee. At the time that we still were trying to figure out how we were going to fund the rest of the park, the state had this rule that cities had to start doing much more to manage their runoff. And so this pond has a pipe that flows into it that comes from the storm sewers, so not the house sewers, but the storm water that comes off the streets up in our neighborhood up through this part of Milwaukee. And that the streets were now set up to go down to this large pipe. The large pipe runs in. We walked over when we were at the entrance. We walked over that. You can sort of see it sticking out through there next to the labyrinth. And so the water goes through there. It goes through a filtration, natural filtration, sitting for a little while. And then if you see the big cement circular on the other side with a grate on it.
Yep.
So then slowly the water goes out that way. It goes under the road and into the river. So that serves the purpose of more filtration time before the water gets to the river, which means more cleaner water. And it also slows down the process of the water getting from the neighborhood down into the river. So it's a little bit of water management as well as keeping it a little cleaner.
So how much input did neighbors have?
Neighbors have had a lot of input. That's been a wonderful thing about this project, is that neighbors have worked very closely with the city of Milwaukee owns the park area. So this is a city park. And then the city of Wauwatosa boundary runs through it. This 6 acres towards the Menominee River, running the whole length of the park, is zoned Wauwatosa. So to work this through this park, we had to have collaboration between the two cities. And then across the Menominee River Parkway is the river, and all that's on the edges of the river is actually county land. So that's, I mean, this is most of it. I will tell you, one of the fun things we haven't talked about yet is on Wednesdays in the summer, we have a farmer's market that the neighbors organize. So that happens right here along the Menominee River Parkway, 4 to 7 p.m. on Wednesdays, mid-June to end of September. We had a playground that brought kids into the park, but we wanted something for adults. And so the market came as a result of having worked on the park, and the people who'd worked together on that had some shared interest in getting more fresh vegetables into the community and supporting local farmers and local businesses. So that's like, well, we could have a market, that'll get adults here, and that's worked out pretty well.
Lynn Worley is a board member of the Hartung Park Community Association. We first spoke with her in April. You'll find more information, including some photos of the park, at WUWM.com. That's all for the Wednesday edition of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. And please join us again tomorrow morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
It's 11 o'clock, and keep listening because fresh air is next.